From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, Angel Insights. We probably need some of that right about now. Here's what's happening. An overheated Samsung device created smoke that caused a plane to be evacuated at the Louisville International Airport. The smoke prompted Southwest Airlines to evacuate the plane before it departed for Baltimore. Now, a total of 75 passengers and crew were evacuated from the flight. No one injured. U.S. safety regulators announced a formal recall last month of Samsung's Galaxy Note 7 smartphone after a number of fires led to injuries and property damage. I'm glad everybody was okay on that plane. As Hurricane Matthew barreled up the Caribbean, people along the Atlantic coast from Florida to South Carolina preparing to move to safer ground as officials warned that hundreds of thousands of people would have to evacuate. Matthew was a dangerous, life-threatening Category 3 storm now, sustained winds of 120 miles an hour. 25 people have so far died in its wake. And a swarm of seismic activity at the Salton Sea that began a week ago prompted scientists to say there was an elevated risk for a big San Andreas Fault earthquake. Now, by Tuesday, the risk had lessened, and the California Governor's Office of Emergency Service in California said that the earthquake advisory period was over, but the impact of that warning was still being felt. For some, it meant checking quake safety lists. Others looked at preparing for the big one, such as bolting down bookshelves to walls and things like that, installing safety latches on kitchen cabinets, strapping down televisions as well. There is panic out there. Cal Ory, author of The Man Who Predicts Earthquakes, about the late Jim Berkland, is with us. Cal, Jim would say wait for a full moon or a new moon, which is a week and a half away, but people are tense. What do you hear?
We do have the full moon on the 16th, and then we have another new moon on the 30th. He would say, okay, channeling into our good friend Jim. He's laughing right now. Yes, I do channel. He's saying that October is definitely a shaky month. We know that. Now, I must tell you, the Alum Rock quake in 2007, there was a swarm that day, and I was on an earthquake website, and we actually got our 5.6 quake October 30th. So there is a possibility. This area can give us a 7.8 or greater.
Wow.
So that's why the scientists are so concerned. This is kind of like, let's look at it as a metaphor, like a mouth. If you have a treble tooth and you keep going to the dentist, you have a cavity, you have a bigger cavity, you have to have a root canal. Guess what? The root canal doesn't work. We have a treble spot. Do you think your dentist cares about the other parts of your mouth that are pretty healthy? No. He's looking at this one spot. That's what the seismologists are doing. So is it a good heads up? Yeah, we're getting prepared. I even got prepared. I bought more water. I stocked up on pet food. I think it's good. You know, we need to have a plan B. It's going to happen. Will it happen in October? I'm going to give it a 60% chance.
That's pretty high, Cal.
Well, I just looked at the map, and, you know, I am an intuitive. I do work psychic networks,
yep.
And I get awesome reviews. I'm good. I have to say, I'm starting to get a gut feeling.
Oh,
one morning, they usually happen early in the morning or late at night.
That's
a Loma Prieta at 5:04, so it can happen anytime. But usually early morning, late at night. I'm starting to see images of going to that map, because I don't think I would feel it up here in Tahoe, but seeing a big red square. And when I get that feeling, that's when I play the slot machines and win, because I get the feeling.
You get the feeling. Now, when was the last time the Office of Emergency Service here in California issued these kinds of warnings?
I just read they do it about twice a year.
Twice a year.
Now, let me tell you, we did have that aggressive swarm in Reno in 2008. I predicted that quake spot on. I think I was on your show a million shows during that time. They had such an aggressive swarm that the governor or mayor of Reno was telling us, hey, prepare. We're going to have a 7.0 or greater. People were calling me from Reno freaking out because they were shallow quakes. Their pets were on Benadryl. Everybody, they were worse than they are right now. It was scary. But you know what? It only ended up into a 4.8, and then it fizzled. So this could fizzle, but we are in the third shakiest state, Alaska, Nevada, California. Wow. So it is what it is.
All right, Cal, we'll check in with you later. Let's hope everyone's wrong. For the past several months, as we've been reporting, creepy clowns have been terrorizing America, with sightings of actual clowns in at least 10 different states. That's growing. These clowns have reportedly tried to lure women and children into woods, chased people with knives and machetes, and yelled at people from cars. They've been spotted hanging out in cemeteries, and they've been caught in the headlights of cars as they appear alongside desolate roads. What the heck is going on? Dr. Peter Breggin is our resident psychiatrist, and of course he has been on as we talked about medication madness. But Peter, something is going on here, copycats in general, but this clown phobia now that's everywhere, including with me, has really started to fester. Why are these people dressing up like clowns doing what they're doing?
Well, I think you just hit the nail on the head. These aren't clowns. These are clown impersonators. And there's not all that many of them. I mean, mostly it's pranks and hysteria. But the media doesn't say what you just said. The media says a clown did this, clown was seen there. You'd think it was Bigfoot or an alligator when it's just a dumb guy in a clown suit. And I think that we need to change the language the way you just did at that moment and just talk about people who are stupid enough to dress up in clown suits to scare people. There's not really all that many of them. It's more the media hysteria, and there's a lot of pranks going on the internet and people calling in and threatening schools. But the sightings seem to be few and far between, and I think instead of calling them clowns, we should just call them stupid guys in suits.
Stupid guys in suits are going to get shot at if they're wearing clown outfits, I got to tell you, Peter.
I think that's right, and I think it's a really dumb thing to do right now, and we talked about it last time. I think as Halloween comes up, don't have your kids in clown suits this year.
No, not at all. Okay, thanks, Peter. Dr. Peter Breggin, his website, Breggin, breggin.com. And we're going to keep following up on that story, by the way, as we get into Halloween and out of it. Just too many whacked out people dressing up like clowns, running around with knives, whether they're trying to scare people or they're serious. Who knows? Human lifespans may be limited to a maximum of 115 years. Push it to 125, according to scientists. Their conclusions, published in the journal Nature, made by analyzing decades of data of human longevity. They said that a rare few may live longer, but the odds were so poor that you'd have to scour 10,000 planet Earths just to find one person 125 years old. Life expectancy, of course, has been increasing since the 19th century, they say, due to safer childbirth, tackling things like cancer and heart disease and vaccines. A Florida couple says that a Fort Myers gas station made a major mistake when they went to fill up their tank. They filled up their tank, cost about $20. They used a credit card, you know how you slip it there in the pump, and off they went. Well, they tried to use the card again, declined. Car tried to use it again, declined. Well, they called up. Credit card company said they bought $10,000 in gasoline. Nope. 27,000 gallons worth. Well, they got that fixed, but what a mess that was. Hey, the race to the red planet, Mars, is on, as Boeing claims its rocket will beat SpaceX to put the first humans on Mars. Now, less than a week after SpaceX CEO Elon Musk unveiled his very ambitious plans to colonize Mars, the CEO of Boeing has announced that his company also has its sights on shuttling people to the neighboring planet. The company is already building a rocket with NASA. This is going to be exciting. In a moment, Dr. John Brandenburg joins me. We're going to be talking about all things Mars, including his book, Death on Mars, next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Dr. John Brandenburg back with us, PhD, plasma physicist. He did his graduate work in California at the Lawrence Livermore National Lab in controlled plasmas for fusion power, and he's worked in defense, energy, space research. Dr. Brandenburg's also been part of the Clementine mission to the moon, which discovered water at the moon's poles. And here he is back on Coast to Coast as we talk about his latest work, Death on Mars. Hey, John, welcome back.
Hey, George, it's great to be back. It's a great honor to be here.
What do you think of this little space battle to get to Mars? You know, Elon Musk, Boeing?
I love it. We got two big rich guys saying, my rocket is better than your rocket, and I'm going to go to Mars first.
Is there money in it for the private companies?
Oh, yes, I believe so. You know, the space tourism is becoming a big deal. And also, the government will pay whoever can establish a transportation system to Mars copious amounts of money to transport their own people to Mars.
So we're still going to have NASA astronauts then, aren't we?
Oh, yes. The government will maintain its own way of doing things, as you know, and that'll be the surrogate, the proxy for the DOD.
So they'll say things like, "Hey, we want to go to Mars. We want to build a little habitat for 15 people," and they'll take bids on that then.
Yes, they will.
Ah, that's how it'll work.
And not only that, I was at the space conference, AIAA. Space Conference 2016 in Long Beach, where I gave papers on the subject. And also I sat in for their big forum. And we're going to Mars.
We are going to Mars. No doubt.
They're going so far as negotiating with the space station partners on what their roles are going to be, including the Russians.
That's going to be exciting. Hey, John, tell us, what is a plasma physicist? What do you do?
A plasma physicist studies, plasma is the fourth state of matter. It's gas that glows and conducts electricity like copper. So it's a lightning bolt, the aurora. The sun is made of pure plasma, all the stars. It's like the gas they confine in tokamaks for fusion energy. That's how I got involved in it. It's just fascinating stuff. It looks like something from a magic workshop. You know, it's light. It basically looks like a glowing area of light, and then you can shape it with magnetic fields and make it do what you want to. But you have to respect it too, because it has a mind of its own.
How'd you get involved in that?
Well, I got very inspired to help in the effort to harness fusion energy, which would be a safer, cleaner form of nuclear power. And I've always been fascinated with electromagnetism ever since I was a child. My parents, in fact, reported that I would not go to sleep at night as a baby until they would put me in the car and drive me up to a nearby substation with a lot of transformers.
Yeah.
When I would listen to the hum, then I would fall fast asleep.
My God, how old were you?
I was 2 years old.
My gosh, you liked the sound of that.
That I did. They told me stories, that I don't remember, being like this, but they said I was just obsessed with electrical stuff when I was 1 year old.
I bet you were wild about playing with magnets and things like that.
Oh, I remember putting a spring around a, the plug on a iron or something and plugging it into the wall and watching the spark.
Oh, jeez. My favorite thing with magnets, John, was to play with metal shavings, putting it on paper, and then you had the magnet underneath it. And
you just to see the lines of force.
You moved it all over the place. That was
great. Oh, I loved all of that stuff. And my uncle, my dear uncle Barney, who was a
you had an uncle named Barney.
I had Uncle Barney.
Who was his name? Barney Brandenburg.
Barney Brandenburg. Well, actually, it was Barney Anderson. He was on my mother's side.
Okay, lucky him.
And we in fact, he never talked about it. We found out later he was actually part of Patton's army during World War II.
Really?
But he never talked about it.
Ugh.
But what he did do is show me how to make electricity electrical circuits and things like this. He was an electrician, and I would just, he was so patient with me. I'd ask him endless questions, and he'd build little motor circuits for me, and then I'd figure out how they worked and stuff. So my uncle on my father's side of the family was William Surrey. He was a physicist. He was a nuclear physicist. He worked on the atomic bomb during World War II. So I was kind of, and I had all these inspirational characters walking around, and so my uncle William Surrey, he helped found the Sierra Club. He was kind of a Indiana Jones kind of character. He went to Antarctica,
yeah,
he climbed Mount Everest, and
it's in your blood.
I guess so. So yeah. Both of these guys were my inspiration, and so I ended up deciding at 11 years old. I rushed up to my pop. My pop was painting a fence in the backyard of our house, and I rushed up to him. And I said, "Dad, I want to be a physicist like, Uncle Will." And my dad just keeps painting these planks on this fence.
Yeah.
Okay, good, son.
Now go back and do what you were doing, right?
What?
Now go back, kid, and do what you were doing.
I can't leave me alone while I paint this fence. And then I said, but I don't know what area of physics to work on, you know, like. So he says to me, why don't you work on unifying gravity and electromagnetism like Einstein?
Well, and you did. As a matter of fact, one of your first books, Beyond Einstein's Unified Field, wasn't it?
Well, when your 11-year-old comes up to you and asks you what to do with his life and you tell them something,
it sticks with you.
It sticks with him.
Yeah.
And so it stuck with me, and he said, it'd be a nice big problem and give you a lot to work on. He says, if you're a dog, it's good to have a big bone to chew on, he says.
Well, he was right.
And then he went back. Well, he came from farm country like my mother. And
yeah.
He was a veterinarian's assistant when he was young. And so he just goes back to painting his fence. And I wandered off into the backyard of our, and thinking deeply, you know, how I would do this. And so I became convinced that I could unify gravity and electromagnetism if I kept working on it. And that has become kind of my big life's work. Mars, believe it or not, was a little bit of a detour for me.
Yeah, that came later too, didn't it?
Right. I was very fascinated with the space program, and you know, part of my motivation was to make anti-gravity so we could have, you know, like Star Trek, we could build our own
warp speed
and things.
Yeah.
Remember you may remember a movie called The Ambushers with Dean Martin. And the opening scene is they launch this flying saucer with electromagnetic drive.
That's
out
right.
Under the desert, you know.
With that hum.
Oh, and I love that movie. I love the women in it, too. But it was a great movie. And I love the opening scene. And I remember seeing that probably, you know, like was 12 or 13 and making a big impression on me that I wanted someday to work on stuff like that. And so I have basically worked for the last 50 years on that problem, and I have made progress.
Good for you. And then we've got a minute to go before the break, John, but
sure,
then
sure.
The involvement with Mars, and we're going to talk about some really dramatic things that you are thinking about on Mars. I mean, this is going to shake everybody by the foundation, but at about what time in your life did you become interested in Mars?
Well, I had gotten my PhD in physics, and I wanted to keep working on fusion energy, but interestingly enough, we'd made enormous progress on fusion energy, and then suddenly the program was kind of stopped, and the price of oil dropped dramatically. This was the Reagan-Carter transition. And I heard, the rumor that basically there'd been a deal, that the Reagan White House, Reagan basically met with the Saudis and said, we'll stop our energy research as long as you lower the price of oil dramatically. And the idea is we're going to hang the Russians, because the Russians need the price of oil high so they can their production costs in Siberia are very high.
Hold on for a second, John. We'll get right back into that when we come back. And welcome back to Coast with Dr. John Brandenburg. We're talking about his latest work, Death on Mars. And the key to this book, the subtitle is The Discovery of a Planetary Nuclear Massacre. And we're going to get you to talk about that. But, John, you were talking about your involvement with Mars, how you got interested in the red planet.
Right. Well, basically, I ended up at Sandia National Labs, which was another nuclear weapons lab, like Livermore, where I went to school. And I wasn't working on fusion anymore. The fusion money had all kind of stopped suddenly. And I was working on electron beam weapons. And what was interesting was the first time I ever saw anything about electron beam weapon was a Japanese science fiction movie called The Mysterians, where they...
Oh, I love that movie.
Oh, it's a great movie. It's got alien abductions and everything. It was made in 1958.
Yep, I was 8 years old. My dad brought me to that movie.
Oh, great movie. And so anyway, so there I was working on the Mysterian death ray at Sandia Labs, and then the nuclear winter thing came through. And this caused just a wave of depression to go through the lab, because a lot of people, you know, they're just family people. They're just thinking, oh, if there's a nuclear war, I'm going to run home, get the wife and kids in the car, and head for the hills in New Mexico. And what happens is then the nuclear winter says, that won't do any good. Everyone will die of cold and starvation if they're not killed by the initial bombs and fallout. And so the origin of the nuclear winter was on Mars, because there had been a big global dust storm. So we were all talking kind of about Mars and the fact that a nuclear war was not survivable by any of us anymore. And here we are at a nuclear weapons lab. And then for some reason I got acutely nervous about the possibility of an accidental nuclear war, because there were a lot of crises going on.
Oh, sure.
Beta and Beirut, and what I didn't know was they had a secret crisis where we were almost as close to a nuclear war as in the Cuban Missile Crisis, called Able Archer.
Mm-hmm.
And myself and a bunch of other people, we would like meet at church and just discuss how this Mexican standoff we were seeing in the Cold War was really dangerous. What had happened was, so all of that was kind of in my mind, and then I saw the work of Vince DiPietro and Greg Molinar on the day after Christmas. I was out home on Christmas vacation.
The Face on Mars.
It was The Face on Mars. It was Cydonia. And they had done really good work enhancing the pictures using electronic methods, and they'd gotten the original data tapes and enhanced them. They had two good pictures of it at two different times of the day, and it was clearly a face, and they'd also found a pyramid nearby, a five-sided pyramid. So I was just fascinated, and I thought, you know, if we found a dead civilization on Mars, this would help end the Cold War. It was like, you know, if there's a barnyard brawl going on and the barn catches fire, everyone stops what they're doing and they go work together and put out the fire.
That's right.
So I thought this discovery could change the course of history in a good way. And so I became involved in a group of people was organized. Vince DiPietro told me about this. Through SRI, it turns out it was the headquarters for remote viewing at the time.
Ingo Swann's group.
Right. Interestingly enough, that same place played host to basically the headquarters of this Mars investigation. And we basically quickly verified that DiPietro and Molinar had handled the data just like they should have. It was very straightforward and honest. So we verified that they'd done good work, and we also did an investigation and found out that Mars could have had a long period of Earth-like history. In fact, the face appears to have been on the shore of an ocean. So the face was there, the pyramid was there, everything was there. And so we rushed off to a Mars conference and presented this, and the whole, we had just an audience of mesmerized people. These were scientists and engineers working on Mars. It was the Case for Mars 2 conference. And one NASA official showed up and looked very grumpy, but everyone else looked like they were just fascinated.
Sure. And who wouldn't be?
We made it, and this was organized by Dick Hoagland, he was, you know, kind of a journalist more than a scientist, but he knew how to promote stuff, that's for sure. And pretty soon that face on Mars is as well known as the George Washington on a dollar bill.
And then when they took a picture of it with the Global Surveyor,
right?
Oh, what a disappointment that was, John.
Well, what they did is they, in fact, it looked had all the markings of a PSYOP program, you know, where you get a bunch of psychologists together.
Yep. And disinformation, everything.
We're talking dense, as I show in the book, and I think Mike Barra.
Yep.
He did a really good analysis of this thing. They basically figured everyone was expecting a picture from directly above, like the first pictures.
That's right.
And in the afternoon, they wanted a picture that looked similar to
just like it.
Picture. Similar viewpoint, similar lighting. So what they did is they took it from the side, basically, an oblique view, almost a profile, and they took it at a much different time of day, so it looked different. Not only that, they didn't enhance it. It was the poorest picture of a piece of Mars they'd ever released. And so Mark Carlotto, who was a brilliant imaging scientist who'd gotten involved, enhanced the picture. And it was just amazing. I show this in the book, and Mike Barra shows it in his book. When you enhance the picture, there's nostrils in the nose, there's ornaments on the helmet.
There's an eyeball.
And there's an eyeball. It's all there. And once you realize you're looking at it from an oblique, at an oblique angle, from kind of, you know, not directly overhead anymore, suddenly it's confirming everything. So we by the way, we immediately got this into the hands of Dan Golden, the head of NASA.
At the time,
he was one
yeah.
of the first people to see the enhanced photo. So he knew that JPL had bamboozled everyone. What they also did is they embargoed the pictures until they knew all of the news people had to file their stories. It's like six. And so they basically chummed them. They just gave them this one horrible picture and said, see, there's nothing here. Move along here.
I mean, I remember seeing it in USA Today, and, you know, that Mesa was just like it was windblown, and there was nothing there. And I'm saying,
that's what they told you.
Yeah.
And what it was is they didn't enhance the pictures.
So. And let me ask you this, though, yeah. John, and then I want to get into your thoughts and theories
about
this. But why do they deceive? Why did they hold back? Don't you think that it would be the greatest thing for science, for NASA, to simply say, we think there had been life on Mars, and look at this?
In the book, I discuss this. You've got to understand, big science is a business. And, you know, occasionally, people's... their goals as far as their institution will get in the way of a scientific investigation.
But this would enhance them all.
A guy retired from JPL told me that it was the common wisdom at JPL was that if you find anything really exciting on Mars, as one senior official told him, we know if we find something really exciting on Mars, the astronauts will come with their big rockets and take Mars away from us. Mars will be owned by Johnson, NASA Johnson, instead of JPL. They think that way.
Do you believe that?
Yep.
Huh.
I've been part of
so maybe they.
And I've always been a team player, and you kind of lose sight of the real goal here is to advance science rather than your own institution.
So maybe they're doing it as a little private thing?
Oh, absolutely. They want to keep Mars. Mars is a gravy train for them. They're getting billions of, and you know, and nobody can question the technical skill of Jet Propulsion Lab. I wouldn't have any data to talk about unless it was Jet Propulsion Lab. What happened though was that Golden knew that they, you know, cooked the picture, basically. So he ordered that more pictures had to be taken.
Late by the Global Surveyor?
By the Global Surveyor and by all the rest of the probes. Finally, they got a probe that wasn't controlled by JPL. It was the Odyssey. It started taking some really nice pictures, and it showed there was still a face. The pyramid still looked like a pyramid. The face still looked like a face.
Yeah. We didn't see all those, though.
Oh, no, you didn't. But they're in the book.
Okay, great. Now, what are you proposing about what happened on Mars a long time ago?
Well, as it turns out, there's another strange thing about Mars besides this remnant of an ocean and what looks like remnants of a civilization. Mars' atmosphere is loaded with particular telltale isotopes that suggest a massive nuclear explosion happened on Mars. When a nuclear weapon goes off, it creates a particular pattern of isotopes.
There's a footprint there.
There's a footprint. There's a fingerprint. And it's much different than just a regular nuclear reactor operating. It gives a lot of what's called xenon 129. And Stan Friedman was asked about this, and he says, "Oh yes," he says, "any alien coming to this planet and sampling our atmosphere can tell we've set off a lot of nuclear weapons here, just because of there's a big." Since 1945, the atmosphere of the Earth has changed, and almost all of the change has been in the amount of xenon 129 in our atmosphere. It's a big spike since 1945, and it's due to the nuclear weapons program. And so on Mars, almost all the xenon is xenon 129. We're talking a massive nuclear explosion, a nuclear explosion big enough to have torn the entire atmosphere of Mars off and blown it into space. I mean, if it would have, this explosion, based on you can do a calculation based on the amount of xenon 129 produced, and it would have taken Mars from looking like Earth to looking like it does now. It would have utterly destroyed the planet's ability to sustain life.
Who, and this is all speculation, obviously,
yes.
But if these were civilizations and somewhat primitive,
yes,
and if there was, you know, explosions, atomic explosions, they had to have come from outside the planetary system.
I know, and normally, George, as a scientist, you try and postulate the simplest hypothesis you can think of to explain a situation. This is called Occam's razor. But in this case, intelligence apparently is involved. We have two separate lines of evidence now that intelligent activity occurred on Mars. One is, of course, the ruins. The other is the this xenon 129 and the other apparent residues. There's a big radioactive scar on Mars where apparently the explosion occurred in midair, and it also created a whole bunch of glass that resembles what's called trinitite, which is a glass made by nuclear explosions on Earth. And so we have all of these lines of evidence indicating this massive nuclear explosion over Mare Acidalium just to the northwest of Cydonia Mensa. So all the fallout and the most powerful shock waves would have come downwind onto Cydonia. And there's another smaller one that is directly to the northwest of Galaxis Chaos, where we found another face.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And all of this is documented in the book, Death on Mars, including all the pictures with frame numbers, so everyone can verify.
Good for you.
So we have this evidence of intelligent activity, but of the worst possible kind. It looks like there was a primitive civilization on Mars, and I don't know what the level of civilization was there, but it looks primitive. There's no evidence of any
high technology,
or airports, or anything like that. It all looks like Mayan or ancient Bronze Age Egypt.
Though I do have to say, though, John, when you watch the Star Wars movies, they've got this incredible technology. They've got flying craft. Yet when you look at how they live, they look like they're living in stone huts.
I know. Well,
which kind of reminds me of Mars.
Well, this is the several people have pointed out to me that I do not know, you know, that my reasons for saying it looks like a primitive civilization is based just on an Earth reference.
Right. I mean, we assume evolution of mankind means big skyscrapers and things like that. Maybe that doesn't happen, in other
words. Maybe that doesn't happen. Maybe since we've never seen a civilization more advanced than our own, we wouldn't know what it looks like.
Exactly. But
maybe we'll be carving big stone faces and things like that in the future.
Well, if they see just Mount Rushmore.
There's Mount Rushmore, right? Well,
there you go.
So it appears to have been a primitive civilization that was humanoid. And then it looks like somebody dropped two massive hydrogen bombs from space, because the explosions were in midair. They didn't leave craters, but they did leave all this glass, as if the thousands of square miles of the Martian surface was turned to glass.
Blasted.
It was made radioactive. The shock waves wrapped all the way around the planet and piled up a bunch of radioactive debris on the far side of the planet, what's called the antipode.
Why wipe out a primitive civilization?
I don't know.
I can't even speculate.
Well, one scenario, perhaps the advanced civilization said, we'd like a piece of your planet,
But wouldn't the nukes render it useless for some time?
That's the interesting thing. It destroyed the. If the calculations of the mass of the size of the explosions were correct, it was overkill. They destroyed the entire planet, so nothing could
sustain.
Nothing could survive.
No.
And so it's almost like you have to look to science fiction scenarios for this, because there's no, but you know, on Earth, people have wiped out primitive civilizations.
Well, if you look at some of the old texts of India,
yes,
clearly they point out nuclear explosions too.
Oh, it looks definitely like a description of nuclear warfare, and they found a city called Mohenjo-Daro, and there's all these, they were digging there and they found all these unburied bodies that were untouched by scavengers, looking as though they died.
I mean, that's where Oppenheimer got his idea from, that, didn't he?
Yes. I have become death, the destroyer of worlds, that was his quote.
Mm-hmm.
When he saw the first nuclear weapon tested, where they made this green glass called Trinitite out of the desert. So I know, George, there's so many questions.
Oh, my God.
All I can say is there's precedent on Earth for advanced peoples wiping out primitive civilizations, like the Spanish wiped out the Aztecs, or like the English settlers wiped out the Tasmanians living on Tasmania.
Something was going on that planet, John. If this is correct, that the planet was literally extinguished.
It was.
Something was going on where they had to get rid of it. Maybe it was a disease. I don't know.
Well, there's also, they wanted to make an example out of it.
Maybe, yeah.
They wanted other people to be frightened. Look what we can do, or what we're willing to do to people who won't cooperate with us. And so it could have been something like that.
Okay, stay with us, John. We're going to come back. Let's talk more about this. Plus, we'll open up the phone lines in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.